but for at least a solid month each summer there were endless strawberries to pick. By an hour after dawn the first flats were mounded over, and the foreman, a white man, stood writing Roman numerals in a black book beside the name of each picker. He sorted the berries in cedar bins while men from the packing company loaded them onto flatbed trucks. The pickers went on filling flats, squatting in the numbered rows. When the harvest was over in early July, they were given a day off for the strawberry festival. A young girl was crowned strawberry princess. The Hakujin put on a salmon bake. The volunteer fire department played a softball game against the Japanese community center team. The garden club displayed strawberries and fuchsia baskets, and the Chamber of Commerce awarded trophies for a float competition. In the dance pavilion at Westport Jensen, the night lanterns were kindled. Tourists from Seattle poured forth from the excursion steamers to perform the Svenska Polka, the Rhinelander, the Schottische, and the Hambone. Everybody came out. Hay farmers, clerks, merchants, fishermen, crabbers, carpenters, loggers, net weavers, truck farmers, junk dealers, real estate brigands, hack poets, ministers, lawyers, sailors, squatters, millwrights, cedar rats, teamsters, plumbers, mushroom foragers, and holly pruners. They picnicked at Birchillville and Sylvan Grove, listened while the high school band played sluggish Sousa marches, and sprawled under trees drinking port wine. One part bacchanal, one part tribal potlatch, one part vestigial New England supper, the entire affair hinged on the coronation of the strawberry princess. Always a virginal Japanese maiden dressed in satin and dusted carefully across the face with rice powder. In an oddly solemn ceremony before the Island County Courthouse at sundown of the inaugural evening. Surrounded by a crescent of basketed strawberries, she received her crown with a bowed head from Amity Harbor's mayor, who wore a red sash from shoulder to waist and carried a decorated scepter. In the hush that ensued, he would announce gravely that the Department of Agriculture, he had a letter, credited their fair island with producing America's finest strawberry, or that King George and Queen Elizabeth, on a recent visit to the city of Vancouver, had been served San Pedro's best for breakfast. A cheer would fly up as he stood with scepter high, his free hand about the young maiden's shapely shoulder. The girl, it turned out, was an unwitting intermediary between two communities, a human sacrifice, who allowed the festivities to go forward with no uttered ill will. The next day, at noon traditionally, the Japanese began picking raspberries. Thus life went forward on San Pedro. By Pearl Harbor Day, there were 843 people of Japanese descent living there, including 12 seniors at Amity Harbor High School who did not graduate that spring. Early on the morning of March 29, 1942, 15 transports of the U.S. War Relocation Authority took all of San Pedro's Japanese-Americans to the ferry terminal in Amity Harbor. They were loaded onto a ship, while their white neighbors looked on, people who had risen early to stand in the cold and watch this exorcising of the Japanese from their midst. Friends, some of them, but the merely curious, mainly, and fishermen who stood on the decks of their boats out in Amity Harbor. The fishermen felt, like most islanders, that this exiling of the Japanese was the right thing to do, and leaned against the cabins of their stern-pickers and bow-pickers with the conviction that the Japanese must go for reasons that made sense. There was a war on, and that changed everything. During the morning recess, the accused man's wife had come alone to the row of seats behind the defendant's table and asked permission to speak with her husband. "You'll have to do it from back there," said Abel Martinson. "Mr. Miyamoto can turn and face you all right, but that's about it, you see. I'm not supposed to let him move around much." Once each afternoon, for 77 days, Hatsue Miyamoto had appeared at the Island County Jail for a 3 o'clock visit with her husband. At first she came alone and spoke with him through a pane of glass, but then he asked her to bring the children. Thereafter she did so, two girls, 8 and 4, who walked behind her, and a boy of 11 months whom she carried in her arms. Kabuo was in jail on the morning their son began to walk. But in the afternoon she brought the boy, and he took 4 steps while his father watched from behind the visiting room windowpane. Afterward she'd held him up to the glass, and Kabuo spoke to him through the microphone. "You can go further than me," he'd said. "You take some steps for me, okay?" Now in the courtroom he turned toward Hatsue. "How are the kids?" he said. "They need their father," she answered. "Nels is working on that," said Kabuo.
"Nels is going to move away," said Nels. "Deputy Martinson ought to do the same. Why don't you stand where you can watch, Abel? But give these people some privacy."
"I can't," replied Abel. "Art'd kill me."
"Art won't kill you," Nels said. "You know darn well Mrs. Miyamoto isn't going to slip Mr. Miyamoto any kind of weapon. Back off a little. Let them talk."
"I can't," said Abel. "Sorry." But he sidled back about 3 feet anyway and pretended not to be listening. Nels excused himself. "Where are they staying?" asked Kabuo. "They're at your mother's. Mrs. Nakao is there. Everybody's helping out." "You look good. I miss you."
"I look terrible," answered Hatsue. "And you look like one of Tojo's soldiers. You'd better quit sitting up so straight and tall. These jury people will be afraid of you."
He fixed his gaze directly on hers, and she could see he was thinking about it. "It's good to be out of that cell," he said. "It feels great to be out of there." Hatsue wanted to touch him then. She wanted to reach out and put her hand on his neck or place her fingertips against his face. This was the first time in 77 days that they had not been separated by a pane of glass. For 77 days, she'd heard his voice only through the filter of a microphone. During this time, she had never once felt composed, and she had stopped imagining their future. At night, she'd brought the children into her bed, then exerted herself fruitlessly toward sleep. She had sisters, cousins, and aunts who called mornings and asked her to come for lunch. She went because she was lonely and needed to hear the sound of voices. The women made sandwiches, cakes, and tea, and chattered in the kitchen while the children played. And this is how the autumn passed, with her life arrested, on hold. Sometimes in the afternoons, Hatsue fell asleep on a sofa. While she slept, these other women cared for her children. And she didn't neglect to thank them for it. But in the past, she would never have done such a thing, fall asleep, drop away in the middle of a visit while her children ran about recklessly. She was a woman of 31 and still graceful. She had the flat-footed gait of a barefoot peasant, a narrow waist, small breasts. She very often wore men's khaki pants, a gray cotton sweatshirt, and sandals. It was her habit in the summer to work at picking strawberries in order to bring home extra money. Her hands were stained in the picking season with berry juice. In the fields, she wore a straw hat low on her head, a thing she had not done consistently in her youth, so that now around her eyes there were squint lines. Hatsue was a tall woman, 5'8", but nevertheless able to squat low between the berry rows for quite some time without pain. Recently she had begun to wear mascara and lipstick. She was not vain, but she understood that she was fading. It was all right with her at 31 if she faded, for it had come to her slowly over the years an ever-deepening realization that there was more to life than the extraordinary beauty she had always been celebrated for. In youth, she had been so thoroughly beautiful that her beauty had been public property. She had been crowned Princess of the Strawberry Festival in 1941. When she was 13, her mother had dressed her in a silk kimono and sent her off to Mrs. Shigemura, who taught young girls to dance odori and to serve tea impeccably. Seated before a mirror with Mrs. Shigemura behind her, she had learned that her hair was utsukushi, and that to cut it would be a form of heresy. It was a river of iridescent onyx. Mrs. Shigemura described it in Japanese, the salient feature of her physical being, as prominent and extraordinary as baldness might have been in another girl of the same age. She had to learn that there were many ways to wear it, that she might tame it with pins, or weave it in a thick plait hanging over one breast, or knot it intricately at the nape of her neck, or sweep it back in such a manner that the broad, smooth planes of her cheeks declared themselves. Mrs. Shigemura lifted Hatsue's hair in her palms and said its consistency reminded her of mercury, and that Hatsue should learn to play her hair lovingly, like a stringed musical instrument or a flute. Then she combed it down Hatsue's back until it lay opened like a fan and shimmered in unearthly black waves. Mrs. Shigemura, on Wednesday afternoons, taught Hatsue the intricacies of the tea ceremony as well as calligraphy and scene painting. She showed her how to arrange flowers in a vase and how, for special occasions, to dust her face with rice powder. She insisted that Hatsue must never giggle and must never look at a man directly. In order to keep her complexion immaculate, Hatsue, said Mrs. Shigemura, had skin as smooth as vanilla ice cream, she must take care to stay out of the sun. Mrs. Shigemura taught Hatsue how to sing with composure and how to sit, walk, and stand gracefully. It was this latter that remained of Mrs. Shigemura. Hatsue still moved with a wholeness of being that began in the balls of her feet and reached right through to the top of her head. She was unified and graceful. Her life had always been strenuous. Field work, internment, more field work on top of housework. But during this period under Mrs. Shigemura's tutelage, she had learned to compose herself in the face of it. It was a matter in part of posture and breathing, but even more so, of soul. Mrs. Shigemura taught her to seek union with the greater life, and to imagine herself as a leaf on a great tree. The prospect of death in autumn, she said, was irrelevant next to its happy recognition of its participation in the life of the tree itself. In America, she said, there was fear of death. Here life was separate from being. A Japanese, on the other hand, must see that life embraces death, and when she feels the truth of this, she will gain tranquility. Mrs. Shigemura taught Hatsue to sit without moving and claimed that she would not mature properly unless she learned to do so for extended periods. Living in America, she said, would make this difficult because here there was tension and unhappiness. At first, Hatsue, who was only 13, could not sit still for even 30 seconds. Then later, when she had stilled her body, she found it was her mind that would not be quiet. But gradually her rebellion against tranquility subsided. Mrs. Shigemura was pleased and claimed that the turbulence of her ego was in the process of being overcome. She told Hatsue that her stillness would serve her well. She would experience harmony of being in the midst of the changes and unrest that life inevitably brings. But Hatsue feared, walking home over forest trails from Mrs. Shigemura's, that despite her training, she was not becalmed. She dallied and sometimes sat under trees, searched for ladies' slippers or white trilliums to pick, and contemplated her attraction to the world of illusions, her craving for existence and entertainment, for clothes, makeup, dances, movies. It seemed to her that in her external bearing she had succeeded only in deceiving Mrs. Shigemura. Inwardly she knew her aspiration for worldly happiness was frighteningly irresistible. Yet the demand that she conceal this inner life was great. And by the time she entered high school, she was expert at implying bodily a tranquillity that did not, in fact, inhabit her. In this way she developed a secret life that disturbed her, and that she sought to cast off. Mrs. Shigemura was open and forthright with Hatsue about matters of a sexual nature. With all the seriousness of a fortune-teller, she predicted that white men would desire Hatsue and seek to destroy her virginity. She claimed that white men carried in their hearts a secret lust for pure young Japanese girls. "Look at their magazines and moving pictures," Mrs. Shigemura said. "Kimonos, sake, rice-paper walls, coquettish and demure geishas. White men had their fantasies of a passionate Japan, girls of burnished skin and willowy long legs going barefoot in the wet heat of rice paddies. And this distorted their sex drives. They were dangerous egomaniacs, and utterly convinced that Japanese women worshipped them for their pale skin and for their ambitious courage. Stay away from white men," said Mrs. Shigemura, "and marry a boy of your own kind, whose heart is strong and good." Her parents had sent Hatsue to Mrs. Shigemura with the intent that the girl would not forget that she was first and foremost Japanese. Her father, a strawberry farmer, had come from Japan, from people who had been pottery makers for as long as anyone in his prefecture could remember. Hatsue's mother, Fujiko, the daughter of a modest family near Kure, hard-working shopkeepers and rice wholesalers, had come to America as Hisao's picture bride on board the Korea Maru. The marriage was arranged by a baishakunin who told the Shibayamas that the potential groom had made a fortune in the new country. But the Shibayamas were owners of a respectable house, and it seemed to them that Fujiko, the daughter in question, could do better than to marry a hired hand in America. Then the baishakunin, whose work was to procure brides, showed them 12 acres of prime mountain land, which he said the potential bridegroom intended to purchase upon his return from America. There were peach and persimmon trees there, and slender, tall cedars, and a beautiful new home with 3 rock gardens. And finally, he pointed out, Fujiko wanted to go. She was young, 19, and wished to see something of the world beyond the sea before settling into her married life. But she had been sick all the way across the ocean, prostrate, clench-bellied, and vomiting. And once in the new country, arriving in Seattle, she found she had married a pauper. Hisao's fingers were calloused and sun-blistered, and his clothing smelled powerfully of field sweat. He had nothing, it turned out, but a few dollars and coins for which he begged Fujiko's forgiveness. At first they lived in a Beacon Hill boarding house, where the walls were plastered with pictures from magazines, and where the white people on the streets outside treated them with humiliating disdain. Fujiko went to work in a waterfront cookhouse. She, too, sweated beneath her clothes, and cut her palms and knuckles working for the Hakujin. Hatsue was born the first of 5 daughters, and the family moved to a Jackson Street boarding house. It was owned by people from Tochigi-ken Prefecture who had done astoundingly well for themselves. The women among them wore silk crepe kimonos and scarlet cork-soled slippers. Jackson Street, though, smelled of rotting fish, cabbages, and radishes fermenting in sea brine, sluggish sewers and diesel streetcar fumes. Fujiko cleaned rooms there for 3 years, until one day Hisao came home with the news that he had procured jobs for them with the National Cannery Company. In May, the Imadas boarded a boat for San Pedro, where there was work to be had in the many strawberry fields. It was hard work, though. Hatsue and her sisters would do a lot of it in their lives, stoop labor performed in the direct sun. But despite that, it was infinitely better than Seattle. The neat rows of strawberries flowed up and down the valleys. The wind brought the smell of the sea to their nostrils, and in the morning the gray light evoked something of the Japan Hisao and Fujiko had left behind. At first they lived in the corner of a barn they shared with an Indian family. Hatsue, at 7, cut ferns in the forest and pruned holly trees beside her mother. Isao sold perch and made Christmas wreaths. They filled a grain sack with coins and bills, leased 7 acres of stumps and vine maple, purchased a plow horse, and started clearing. Autumn came, the maple leaves curled into fists and dropped away, and the rain ground them into an auburn paste. Isao burned piles and pried stumps from the earth in the winter of 1931. A house of cedar slats went up slowly. The land was tilled, and the first crop planted in time for the pale light of spring. Hatsue grew up digging clams at South Beach, picking blackberries, collecting mushrooms, and weeding strawberry plants. She was mother, too, to 4 sisters. When she was 10, a neighborhood boy taught her how to swim and offered her the use of his glass-bottomed box so that she could look beneath the surface of the waves. The two of them clung to it, their backs warmed by the Pacific sun, and together watched starfish and rock crabs. The water evaporated against Hatsue's skin, leaving a residue of salt behind. Finally, one day, the boy kissed her. He asked if he might, and she said nothing either way, and then he leaned across the box and put his lips on hers for no more than a second. She smelled the warm, salty interior of his mouth before this boy pulled away and blinked at her. Then they went on looking through the glass at anemones, sea cucumbers, and tube worms. Hatsue would remember on the day of her wedding that her first kiss had been from this boy, Ishmael Chambers, while they clung to a glass box and floated in the ocean. But when her husband asked if she had kissed anyone before, Hatsue had answered, never. "It's coming down hard," she said to him now, lifting her eyes to the courtroom windows. "A big snow. Your son's first." Kabuo turned to take in the snowfall, and she noticed the thick sinews in the left side of his neck above where his shirt was buttoned. He hadn't lost any of his strength in jail. His strength, as she understood it, was an inward matter, something he tuned silently to the conditions of life. In his cell he had composed himself to preserve it. "Check the root cellar, Hatsue," he said. "You don't want anything to freeze." "I've been checking," she answered. "Everything's fine." "Good," said Kabu. "I knew you would." He watched the snow for a silent moment, the needles of it blurring past the leaded panes, then turned again to look at her. "Do you remember that snow at Manzanar?" he said. "Whenever it snows, I think of that. The drifts and the big wind and the pot-bellied stove and the starlight coming through the window." It was not the sort of thing he would normally have said to her, these romantic words. But perhaps jail had taught him to release what otherwise he might conceal. "That was jail, too," said Hatsue. "There were good things, but that was jail." "It wasn't jail," Kabuo told her. "We thought it was back then, because we didn't know any better, but it wasn't jail." She knew as he spoke that this was true. They'd been married at the Manzanar internment camp in a tar-paper Buddhist chapel. Her mother had hung woolen army blankets to divide the Imada's cramped room in half and had given them, on their wedding night, 2 cots adjacent to the stove. She had even pushed the cots together to form 1 bed and smoothed their sheets with her palms. Hatsue's sisters, all 4 of them, had stood beside the curtain, watching while her mother went about her silent business. Fujiko loaded coal into the pot-bellied stove and wiped her hands on her apron. She nodded and said they should close the damper when 45 minutes had gone by. and she took her daughters out with her, and left Hatsue and Kabuo behind. They stood beside the window in their wedding clothes, and kissed, and she smelled his warm neck and throat. Outside, snow had drifted against the barracks wall.
"They'll hear everything,"
Hatsue whispered. Kabuo, his hands at her waist, turned and spoke to the curtain. "There must be something good on the radio," he called. "Wouldn't some music be nice?" They waited. Kabuo hung his coat on a peg. In a little while, a station from Las Vegas came on, country and western music. Kabuo sat down and removed his shoes and socks. He put them under the bed neatly. He unknotted his bow tie. Hatsue sat down beside him. She looked at the side of his face for a moment, at the scar on his jaw, and then they kissed.
"I need help with my dress," she whispered.
"It unhooks in the back, Kabuo." Kabuo unclasped it for her. He ran his fingers along her spine. She stood and pulled the dress from her shoulders. It dropped to the floor, and she picked it up and hung it on the peg beside his coat. Hatsue came back to the bed in her bra and slip and sat down beside Kabuo.
"I don't want to make a lot of noise," she said. "Even with the radio, my sisters are listening."
"Okay," said Kabuo,
quietly.
He unbuttoned his shirt, stripped it off, and set it on the end of the cot. He pulled his undershirt off. It was very strong. She could see the muscles flowing in his abdomen. She was glad to have married him. He, too, came from strawberry farmers. He was good with the plants and knew which runners to cut. His hands, like hers, were berry-stained in the summer months. The red fruit mingled with his skin and scented it. She knew that in part because of this smell, she wanted to tie her life to his. It was something she understood in her nose, finally, as odd as that might seem to others. And she knew that Kabuo wanted what she wanted, a San Pedro strawberry farm. That was all. There was nothing more than that. They wanted their farm, and the closeness at hand of the people they loved, and the scent of strawberries outside their window. There were girls Hatsue's age, she knew very well, who felt certain their happiness was something other, who wanted to go to Seattle or Los Angeles. They could not say in any precise way exactly what it was they sought in the city, only that they wanted to go there. It was something Hatsue herself had once felt, but had since emerged from as if from a dream, discovering the truth of her private nature. It was in her to have the composure and tranquility of an island strawberry farmer. She knew in her bones what she wanted, and she knew why she wanted it, too. She understood the happiness of a place where the work was clear, and there were fields she could enter into with a man she loved purposefully. And this was what Kabuo felt, too, and what he wanted from life. And so they made plans together. When the war was over, they would return to San Pedro. Kabuo was rooted there just as she was, a boy who understood the earth and the working of it, and how it was a good thing to live among people one loved. He was precisely the boy Mrs. Shigemura had described for her so many years ago when she'd spoken of love and marriage. And now she kissed him, hard, because of that. She kissed his jaw and forehead more softly, and then she put her chin against the top of his head and held his ears between her fingers. His hair smelled like wet earth. Kabuo put his hands against her back and pulled her deeply to him. He kissed the skin just over her breasts and put his nose against her bra. "You smell so good," he said. He drew away and stripped his pants off and laid them next to his shirt. They sat there beside each other in their underwear. His legs shone in the light from the window. She could see beneath the fabric of his underpants how his penis stood erect. The end of it pushed his shorts into the air. Hatsue brought her feet up onto the bed and propped her chin on her knees.
"They're listening," she said. "I know they are."
"Could you turn the radio up?" Kabuo called. "We can't hear it so well in here."
The country and western music grew louder. And they were very quiet at first. They lay on their sides and faced one another, and she felt his hardness against her belly. She reached down and touched it beneath the fabric of his shorts, the tip of it and the ridge just below. She could hear the coal burning in the pot-bellied stove. She remembered how she had kissed Ishmael Chambers, clinging to that wooden box. He was a brown-skinned boy who lived down the road. They'd picked blackberries, climbed trees, fished for perch. She thought of him while Kabuo kissed the undersides of her breasts, and then her nipples through the fabric of her bra. And she recognized Ishmael as the beginning of a chain, that she had kissed a boy when she was 10 years old, had even then felt something strange, and that tonight, soon, she would feel another boy's hardness deep inside of her. But it was not difficult for her, on her wedding night, to then cast Ishmael out of her mind completely. He had only crept in by accident, as it were, because all romantic moments are associated willy-nilly, even when some are long dead. In a little while, her husband took off her slip and underpants and unhooked her bra, and she pulled down his shorts. They were naked, and she could see his face in the starlight from the window. It was a good face, strong and smooth. The wind was blowing hard outside now, and the sound of it whistled between the boards. She put her hand around Kabuo's hardness and squeezed it, and it pulsed once in her hand. Then, because she wanted it this way, she fell onto her back without letting go, and he was on top of her with his hands on her buttocks.
"Have you ever done this before?" he whispered.
"Never," answered Hatsue. "You are my only."
The head of his penis found the place it wanted. For a moment he waited there, poised, and kissed her. He took her lower lip between his lips and gently held it there. Then with his hands he pulled her to him, and at the same time entered her so that she felt his scrotum slap against her skin. Her entire body felt the rightness of it. Her entire body was seized to it. Hatsue arched her shoulder blades. Her breasts pressed themselves against his chest, and a slow shudder ran through her.
"It's right," she remembered whispering. "It feels so right, Kabuo."
"Tadaima, Awaregawakata," he had answered. "I understand just now the deepest beauty."
Eight days later, he left for Camp Shelby, Mississippi, where he joined the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. He had to go to the war, he told her. It was necessary in order to demonstrate his bravery. It was necessary to demonstrate his loyalty to the United States, his country. "You can die demonstrating all of that," she told him. "I know you are brave and loyal." He went despite these words of hers. She had spoken them many times before their wedding. Often she'd urged him not to go, but he had not been able to bring himself to stay away from the fighting. It was not only a point of honor, he'd said. It was also a matter of having to go because his face was Japanese. There was something extra that had to be proved, a burden this particular war placed on him. And if he would not carry it, who would? She saw that in this he would not be swayed, and recognized the hardness buried in him, the part of her husband that was attracted to the fighting and wanted to enter it desperately. There was a place in him she could not reach, where he made his choices in solitude. and this made her not only uneasy about him, but afraid for their future, too. Her life was joined to his now, and it seemed to her that every corner of his soul should be opened to hers because of this. It was the war, she persistently told herself. It was the prison of camp life, the pressures of the times, their exile from home that explained his distance. Many men were going off to the war against the wishes of women. A lot of them leaving the camp each day, droves of young men going. She told herself she must endure it in the way her mother and Kabuo's mother counseled her, and not struggle against those larger forces that could not be struggled against. She was in the stream of history now, as her mother before her had been. She must travel in it easily, or her own heart would devour her, and she would not endure the war unwounded, as she still hoped to do. Hatsue settled into missing her husband, and learned the art of waiting over an extended period of time. A deliberately controlled hysteria that was something like what Ishmael Chambers felt watching her in the courtroom. Chapter 8. Ishmael Chambers, watching Hatsue, remembered digging gooey duck clams with her below the bluff at South Beach. Hatsue, carrying a garden shovel and a metal pail rusted through in its bottom, dripped water behind her as she walked the tide flats. She was 14 and wore a black bathing suit. She went barefoot, avoiding barnacles, picking her way along the flats with the tide drawn out and the salt chuck grass sleek against the mud in sun-dried fans. Ishmael wore rubber boots and clutched a gardener's hand spade. The sun struck his shoulders and back as he walked and dried the mud on his knees and hands. They wandered for nearly a mile. They stopped to swim. At the turning of the tide, the horse clams emerged, shooting jets of water like miniature geysers hidden among the eel grass. Down the mud flats, small fountains erupted, dozens of them, spurting 2 feet or more, then again, then lower, then dwindling, and stopping. The gooey ducks raised their necks from the mud and aimed their lips at the sun. The siphons at the ends of their necks glistened. They blossomed delicately white and iridescent out of the tidal morass. The two of them knelt beside a clam siphon to discuss the particulars of its appearance. They were quiet and made no sudden movements. Movement inspired shyness among clams and encouraged them to withdraw. Hatsue, her bucket beside her, her shovel in one hand, pointed out the darkness of the exposed clam's lip, its size, its hue and tone, the circumference of its watery dimple. She decided they'd stopped beside a horse clam. They were 14 years old. Gooey ducks were important. It was summer, and little else really mattered. They came to a second siphon and knelt again. Hatsue, sitting on her ankles, twisted the salt water out of her hair so that it dripped along her arm. She lofted her hair out neatly behind her and let it spread against her back to catch the sun.
"Gooey duck," she said quietly. "A good one," Ishmael agreed.
Hatsue bent forward and slipped a forefinger inside the siphon. They watched while the clam seized up around it and drew its neck into the mud. She followed its retreating path with the point of an alder stick. Its 2 feet of length disappeared.
"He's way down there," she said, "and he's big." "My turn to dig," answered Ishmael.
Hatsue handed him her shovel. "The handle's coming loose," she warned. "Be careful it doesn't break." The shovel brought butter clams, sticks and sea worms up with it. Ishmael built a dike against the turning of the tide. Hatsue bailed with the leaking pail, stretched out flat against the warm mud, the backs of her legs smooth and brown. When the alder stick fell over, Ishmael dropped down beside her and watched while she scraped with the hand spade. The clam siphon came into view. They saw the aperture through which its neck had retreated. They lay at the edge of the hole together, each with a muddy arm hung in, and excavated around it until a third of the shell showed.
"Let's pull it now," suggested Ishmael.
"We'd better get under it," answered Hatsue.
He had taught her to dig gooey ducks, and they had dug them for 4 summers, but in the end she'd surpassed him in it. There was this way she had of speaking with certainty that he found entirely convincing.
"He's still got a good grip," she pointed out. "He'll break if we start pulling. Let's be patient and dig some more. It's better if we keep digging."
When the time came to pull, he slid his hand down as far as he could so that the side of his face lay against the mud, turned toward Hatsue's knee. He was close enough so that her knee was his whole view of things, and he smelled the salt on her skin.
"Gentle," she urged. "Slow. Easy is the way. Don't hurry it. Slow is best."
"He's coming," Ishmael grunted. "I can feel him."
Afterward, she took the clam from between his fingers and rinsed it off in the shallows. She rubbed the shell with the heel of her palm and cleaned the long neck and foot. Ishmael took the clam back and put it in the bucket. Clean and delicate, as large as any he had seen, it was approximately the size and shape of a turkey breast carved away from the bone. He admired it, turned it in his hand. He was always surprised at the thickness and heft of a gooey duck.
"We found a good one," he said.
"He's huge," answered Hatsue.
"Enormous."
She stood in the shallows, rinsing mud from her legs, while Ishmael filled in the hole. The tide skated in over sun-heated flats, and the water was as warm as a lagoon. The two of them sat side by side in the shallows, facing out toward the expanse of the ocean, kelp draped across their legs.
"It goes forever," said Ishmael.
"There's more water than anything in the world."
"It ends somewhere," answered Hatsue. "Or it just goes around and around."
"That's the same thing. It's forever."
"There's a shore somewhere right now where the tide is up," explained Hatsue. "And that's the end of the ocean."
"It doesn't end. It meets another one. And pretty soon the water is back and it all mixes together."
"Oceans don't mix," said Hatsue. "They're different temperatures. They have different amounts of salt."
"They mix underneath," said Ishmael. "It's all really just one ocean." He lay back on his elbows, draped a strand of seaweed across his thighs, and settled in again.
"It's not one ocean," said Hatsue. "It's 4 oceans, Atlantic, Pacific, Indian, Arctic. They're different from each other."
"Well, how are they different?"
"They just are."
Hatsue lay back on her elbows beside him and let her hair fall behind.
"Just because," she added.
"That's not a good reason," Ishmael said. "The main thing is, water is water. Names on a map don't mean anything. Do you think if you were out there in a boat and you came to another ocean, you see a sign or something, it..."
"The color would change. I've heard that," said Hatsue.
"The Atlantic Ocean is brown, sort of, and the Indian Ocean is blue."
"Where'd you hear that?"
"I don't remember."
"It isn't true."
"Yes, it is." They were silent. There was the lapping of the water and no other sound. Ishmael was aware of her legs and arms. The salt had dried at the corners of her lips and left a residue behind. He noticed her fingernails, the shape of her toes, the hollow place at her throat. He had known her for 6 years, and he had not known her. The detached part of her, the part she kept to herself, had begun to interest him deeply. It made him unhappy when he thought about her lately, and he had passed a lot of time, all spring long, mulling how to tell her about his unhappiness. He'd sat on top of the bluff at South Beach, thinking about her in the afternoons. He'd thought about it during school. His thoughts, however, yielded no clue as to how to talk to Hatsue. Words evaded him completely. He felt in her presence that to reveal himself would be a mistake he might never correct. She was closed up and offered him no opening for talk, though for years now they had walked from the school bus together, met on the beach and in the woods to play, picked berries on the same nearby farms.
They had played together as children in a group that included her sisters and other kids. Sheridan Knowles, Arnold and Bill Kruger, Lars Hansen, Tina and Jean Sivertson. They had passed autumn afternoons when they were 9 years old in the hollowed-out base of a cedar tree, where they sprawled on the ground, looking out at the rain as it pummeled the sword ferns and ivy. At school they were strangers for reasons unclear to him, though at the same time he understood it had to be that way, because she was Japanese, and he wasn't. It was the way things were. And there was nothing to be done about such a basic thing. She was 14, and her breasts were beginning to show beneath her bathing suit. They were small and hard, like apples. He could not put his finger on how else she had changed, but even her face was different. The texture of its skin had changed. He had watched her change, and when he sat close to her, as he did now in the water, he felt driven and nervous. Ishmael's heart began the fretful pounding he'd experienced of late in her presence. There were no words for what he had to say, and his tongue felt paralyzed. He couldn't stand another moment without explaining his heart to her. A knot of pressure was building inside him to declare the love he felt. It was not only that her beauty moved him, but that they already had a history together that included this beach, these waters, the very stones, and the forest at their backs, too. It was all theirs, and always would be. And Hatsue was the spirit of the place. She knew where to find Matsutake mushrooms, elderberries, and fern tendrils, and she had found them now for years at his side, and they had taken each other for granted. They had been as easy as friends about it all, until these last few months. Now he was in pain about her, and he understood that he would continue in his pain unless he did something about it. It was up to him. It took courage, and it made him feel ill, this unasked-for thing. It was too hard. He shut his eyes. "I like you," he confessed with his eyes still shut. "Do you know what I mean? I've always liked you, Hatsue." She didn't answer. She didn't even look at him. She looked down. But having started it, he moved into the warmth of her face anyway and put his lips against hers. They were warm, too. There was the taste of salt and the heat of her breathing. He pushed too hard, and she planted one hand beneath the water behind her to keep from falling over. She pushed back against him, and he felt the pressure of her teeth and smelled the inside of her mouth. Their teeth clashed a little. He shut his eyes and then opened them again. Hatsue's eyes were tightly shut. She wouldn't look at him. Just as soon as they were no longer touching, she leaped up and went for her gooey duck pail and ran away down the beach. She was very fast, he knew that. He stood up only to watch her go. Then, after she had disappeared into the woods, he lay in the water for another 10 minutes, feeling the kiss many times. He decided then that he would love her forever, no matter what came to pass. It was not so much a matter of deciding as accepting the inevitability of it. It made him feel better, though he felt perturbed, too, worried that this kiss was wrong. But from his point of view, at 14 years old, their love was entirely unavoidable. It had started on the day they'd clung to his glass box and kissed in the sea. And now it must go on forever. He felt certain of this. He felt certain Hatsue felt the same way. For 10 days after that, Ishmael worked. Odd jobs and stray chores, weeding and window washing, and worried about Hatsue Imada. She stayed away from the beach intentionally, it seemed to him in his fretfulness, and gradually he became dark and morose. He battened down the guy wires over which Mrs. Verda Carmichael's raspberries were trellised, straightened out the contents of her shadowy tool shed, and bundled up her cedar kindling, all of it permeated by thoughts about Hatsue. He helped Bob Timmons scrape paint from his shed and weeded flower beds with Mrs. Herbert Crow, a woman who concerned herself with flower arrangements and treated Ishmael's mother formally. Now, seated on a knee pad, Mrs. Crow worked beside Ishmael with a maple-handled claw, stopping every now and then to wipe sweat from her brow with the back of her forearm and to exclaim that he seemed blue. Later she decided they would sit on the back porch and sip tall glasses of iced tea and lemon wedges. She pointed to a fig tree and told Ishmael she'd planted it more years ago than she could remember. Against all odds it had taken hold and produced enormous quantities of sweet figs. Mr. Crow greatly approved of figs, she added. She sipped her tea, then changed the subject. The families up and down South Beach, she said, were thought of by folks in Amity Harbor as self-styled aristocrats and malcontents, seclusion-seekers and eccentrics, Ishmael's family included. Did he know that his grandfather had helped to drive the pilings for the wharf at South Beach Bay Landing? The Papineaus, she said, were dirt poor for a reason. None of them did any work. The Amadas, on the other hand, were consistently hard workers, including the five little girls. The Eberts hired professional gardeners and various domestic troubleshooters. Plumbers, electricians, and handymen arrived in step vans to do their dirty work, but the Crows always hired neighborhood people. For 40 years, she reminded Ishmael, she and Mr. Crow had lived right there at South Beach. Mr. Crow had been in coal mining and the manufacturing of pallet boards, but had recently gone into the shipbuilding business and was right now in Seattle financing the construction of frigates and minesweepers for Roosevelt's Navy, though he didn't care a lick for Roosevelt, she said. But why was Ishmael so blue? Cheer up, urged Mrs. Crow, and sipped her tea. Life was wonderful. Fishing with Sheridan Knowles that Saturday, rowing the shoreline and worrying about Hatsue, Ishmael saw Mr. Crow, with his hands on his knees, peering into a telescope mounted on a tripod in the center of his terraced lawn. From this vantage point, he jealously inspected the yachts of the Seattleites who cruised past South Beach on their way to anchorages in Amity Harbor. Mr. Crow was a man of uncertain temper, with a high, severe forehead like Shakespeare's. His vista of the sea was a wide and windy one. His gardens were planted with low azalea hedges, camellias, sterina roses, and espaliered boxwoods, all framed by the white caps on the shuffling waters and the annealed gray of the beach stones. His house turned a great immaculate wall of shuttered windows to the sun, cedars surrounding it on three sides imperiously. Mr. Crow had entered into a sort of border war with Bob Timmons, his neighbor to the north, claiming that Bob's grove of western hemlocks actually grew on his property. One morning, when Ishmael was 8 years old, a pair of surveyors had showed up with their transits and alidades and knotted red flagging everywhere. This ceremony was repeated at odd intervals over the years, and while the faces of the surveyors changed, nothing else did except that the hemlocks grew taller, their limber tips bent like green whips against the sky. Bob Timmons, a transplanted son of the New Hampshire uplands and a pale, wordless, determined man of puritanical sensibilities, looked on without expression, hands braced against his hips, while Mr. Crow grumbled and paced with his high forehead glistening. Ishmael worked, too, for the Etheringtons, who were vigorous summer people from Seattle. In June each year, the summer people arrived en force to take up balmy residence along South Beach. Here they meandered in their tiny sailboats, tacking and coming about. They painted, hoed, swept, and planted when the mood for therapeutic work struck them, and lolled on the beach when they felt like it.
In the evenings there were bonfires and steamer clams, mussels, oysters, and perch. The boats dragged up beyond the tide line, the shovels and rakes hosed off and put away. The Etheringtons drank gin and tonics. At the head of Miller Bay, beyond the mudflats, lived Captain Jonathan Sutherland, who'd plied his decrepit windjammer, the C.S. Murphy, to the Arctic each year on trading expeditions. He had finally gotten too old for it, and spent his time telling lies to the summer people. Stroking his snowy beard, dressed in woolen long johns and ragtag suspenders, and posing for photographs at the wheel of the Murphy, which was permanently lodged in the mudflats. Ishmael helped him split firewood. The only viable profit-seeking concern on South Beach, other than the Amada's strawberry enterprise, was Tom Peck's Great American Blue Fox Farm. On the far side of Miller Bay, in the shadows of Madrona trees, Tom Peck tugged at his burnt-red goatee, sucked on his pipe stem, and raised American blue foxes for their varnished pelts in 68 overcrowded breeding pens. The world left him thoroughly alone in this, although Ishmael and two other boys were hired that June to clean the cages with wire brushes. Peck had accumulated a personal mythology that included Indian wars, gold mining, and mercenary executions, and was known to carry a Derringer pistol in a hidden shoulder holster. Farther up the bay, on the deadwater east arm known as Little House Cove, the Westinghouse family had built a Newport-style mansion on 30 acres of Douglas fir trees. Troubled by the general moral demise of the East, manifest particularly in the Lindbergh kidnapping, the well-known home appliance magnate and his high-born Bostonian wife had brought their three sons, a maid, a cook, a butler, and a pair of private tutors to San Pedro's secluded shores. Ishmael, one long afternoon, helped Dale Papineau, self-appointed caretaker for half a dozen summer families, prune back the alder branches overarching their long drive. Ishmael worked with Dale, too, to clean the Etherington's gutters. The Etheringtons mostly humored him, it seemed to Ishmael. For them, he was a colorful island character, part of the charm of the place. After a freeze or 2 days of hard rain, Dale would plod from house to house with a flashlight in hand, limping because the hip he dislocated at the creosote plant ached when it was damp or cold, or both together, and squinting because he was too vain to wear glasses, and poke around garages and basements, clearing mud from the drains. In the fall he burned brush piles and raked leaves for Virginia Gatewood, a stick figure at twilight in cloth gloves and a threadbare Mackinaw coat ragged at the elbows. The veins in his cheeks were broken and smashed flat and appeared as a sort of blue paste beneath his skin. His Adam's apple bulged like a toad's. He looked, to Ishmael, vaguely like an alcoholic scarecrow. 4 days after the kiss on the beach, just after dusk, it was dark in the woods, but the strawberry fields lay in twilight, Ishmael crouched at the edge of the Amada's farm and watched for half an hour. To his surprise, no boredom overtook him, and so he stayed for an hour more. It was a kind of relief to rest his cheek against the earth underneath the stars, and to have some hope of seeing Hatsue. The fear of being discovered and labeled a peeping Tom urged him to move on, finally, and he had almost convinced himself to leave, was getting up, in fact, when the screen door creaked open, light slipped across the porch, and Hatsue crossed to one of the corner posts. She lifted a wicker basket to the cedar railing and began drawing in her family's laundry. Ishmael watched Hatsue pull sheets from the line, standing in a pool of muted porch light with her arms illuminated and elegant. Clenching clothespins between her teeth, she folded towels, pants, and work shirts before dropping them into the wicker basket. When she finished, she leaned against the corner post for a moment, scratching her neck and looking at the stars, then smelling the dampness in the fresh laundry. Then she took her basket of sheets and clothes and melted back into the house. Ishmael returned the following evening. 5 nights in a row, he spied religiously. Each night he told himself not to return, but On the next, he would take a walk at dusk. His walk would become a pilgrimage. He would feel guilt and shame. He would top the groundswell that buttressed her strawberries and pause before the sweep of her fields. He wondered if other boys did this sort of thing, if his voyeurism constituted a disease. He was sustained, though, by seeing her once more reel in laundry, elegant hand over elegant hand. Drop the clothespins in a bucket on the railing, then fold shirts, sheets, and towels. Once she stood on the porch for a moment, brushing the dust from her summer dress. She corralled the long sweep of her hair in, deftly, and knotted it before going inside. On the last night of his spying, he saw her empty a bucket of kitchen scraps not 50 yards from where he crouched. She appeared in the porch light, as always, without warning, and shut the door behind her gently. As she moved in his direction, his heart lurched before freezing altogether in his chest. He could see her face now, and hear the thock of her sandals. Hatsue turned down between strawberry rows and upended her bucket on the compost heap, glanced at the moon so that its blue light caught her face, then returned to the house by a different route. He caught a glimpse of her through the interstices of raspberry canes before she emerged in front of her porch with one hand knotting her hair at her neck and the bucket dangling from the other. He waited, and in a moment she was at the kitchen window with a nimbus of light around her head. Moving closer, keeping low, Ishmael saw her smoothing hair from her eyes while soap suds ran from her fingers. There were young strawberries growing on the plants around him, and their fragrance filled up the night. He moved closer until the Amara's dog came loping around the corner of the house, and then he froze, prepared to bolt. The dog sniffed for a moment, whined, sidled toward him and allowed him to stroke her head and ears, and licked his palm, and lay down. She was a jaundiced, stained-toothed and lopsided old hound, leathery-looking and sway-backed, and her sad eyes wept miserably. Ishmael rubbed her belly. The dog's gray tongue lolled in the dust, and her ribcage pumped up and down. A moment later, Hatsue's father came onto the porch and called to the dog in Japanese. He called again, a low guttural command, and the dog raised her head, barked twice, sprang to her feet, and limped away. That was the last time Ishmael spied at the Amara place. At the start of the strawberry season, at 5:30 in the morning, Ishmael saw Hatsue on the South Beach wood path underneath silent cedars. They were both of them going to work for Mr. Nita. He paid better than any berry farmer on the island, for 35 cents a flat. He walked behind her, his lunch in hand. He caught up and said hello. Neither said anything about their kiss on the beach 2 weeks before. They walked the path quietly, and Hatsue suggested there was a chance they'd see a black-tailed deer out feeding on fern tendrils. She'd seen a doe the previous morning. Where the path met the beach, the madrona trees leaned out over the tidal water. Slender and sinuous, olive-green, mahogany-red, scarlet and ash, they were weighted with broad, gleaming leaves and velvet berries and shaded the beach stones and mudflats. Hatsue and Ishmael flushed a roosting blue heron with feathers the hue of beach mud. It squawked once, and, elongated wingtips wide, graceful even in sudden flight, crossed Miller Bay at a soaring angle to perch in the dead top of a far tree. The path looped around the head of the bay, then down into a swale known as Devil's Dip. Ground fog shrouded its thimbleberry and devil's club, such was the clammy, low wetness of the place, then climbed among cedars and the shadows of spruces before descending into Center Valley. The homesteads here were old and productive ones. The Andreasons, the Olsons, the McCullys, the Coxes. Oxen had been used to cultivate their fields, descendants of the oxen brought to San Pedro in the old log-skidding days. They were enormous, pungent, and hoary beasts. And Ishmael and Hatsue stopped to stare at one, rubbing his hindquarters against a fence post. At Nita's farm, the Canadian Indians were already busy when they arrived. Mrs. Nita, a small woman with a waist no larger than a soup tin, darted up and down the rows like a hummingbird beneath her straw picking hat. Her mouth, like her husband's, was full of gold fillings, and when she smiled, the sun glinted in among them. In the afternoons, she sat beneath a canvas umbrella with a pencil between her fingers, her accounts laid out on a cedar crate before her, one palm laid against her forehead. Her handwriting was impeccable. Small, soft, and elegant numbers filled the pages of her account book. She wrote with the quiet deliberation of a court scribe, sharpening her pencil often. Ishmael and Hatsue went their separate ways to pick among their friends. The farm was so large that a leased, battered school bus carried workers to its dusty gate at the height of picking season. An aura of manic purpose hung over the fields, for in them went forward a gleeful harvest performed by children only just freed from school. San Pedro children delighted in their field toil, in part because of the social life it provided, in part because it furnished the illusion that a job had been included in the summer's proceedings. The rich heat, the taste of berries on the tongue, the easy talk, and the prospect of spending money on soda pop, firecrackers, fishing lures, and makeup all seduced them toward Mr. Nita's. All day, the children knelt beside one another in the fields, hunkered down close against the earth beneath the heat of the sun. Romances began and ended there. Children kissed at the verges of fields or walking home through the woods. Ishmael, from three rows off, watched Hatsue at her work. Her hair soon came loose from its arrangement, and a sheen of sweat appeared against her collarbones. She picked deftly and had a reputation for speed and efficiency. She filled two flats in the time it took other pickers to fill one and a half. She was among friends, a half-dozen Japanese girls, squatting in the rows together, their faces shrouded by straw hats, and would not acknowledge that she knew him when he passed her with his own flat mounded high. He passed her again with his emptied flat, and saw how intent she was on her picking, never hurrying but never stopping. He squatted again in his spot, three rows distant, and tried to concentrate on his own work. When he looked up, she was sliding a berry into her mouth, and he stopped to watch her eat it. Hatsue turned and met his eyes, but he could not discern in this her feelings, and it seemed to him wholly an accident. She meant nothing by it. Looking away, she ate another berry with no embarrassment, slowly. Then, adjusting herself on her haunches for a moment, she went back to her methodical work. Late in the afternoon at about 4:30, heavy clouds shadowed the strawberry fields. The clean June light went softly gray, and a breeze came up in the southwest. It was possible, then, to smell the rain coming, and to feel the cool pause before the first drops fell. The air turned thick. Sudden gusts caught the cedars at the edge of the fields and flailed their tops and branches. The pickers hurried their last flats in and waited in line while Mrs. Nita put marks beside their names and paid them from underneath her umbrella. The pickers craned their necks to watch the clouds and held their palms out to check for rain. At first, just a few drops raised tiny wisps of dust around them, and then, as if a hole had been punched in the sky, an island summer rain poured hard against their faces, and the pickers began moving toward shelter of any kind, the doorway of a barn, the inside of a car, the berry storage sheds, the cedar woods. Some stood with flats held over their heads and let their picked strawberries catch the water. Ishmael saw Hatsue cross the Nita's upper fields and slip into the cedar woods going south. He found himself following, slowly at first, letting the rain pound him as he moved through the strawberries. He was already soaked, so what difference could it make? The rain was warm and felt good on his face, and then he was trotting through the forest. The South Beach Trail, with its canopy of cedars, was as good a place as any in a rainstorm. And he wanted to walk at home with her, saying nothing if that was what she desired. But when he caught sight of her below the McCullys' farm, it occurred to him to slow to a walking pace and follow along at 50 yards. The rain would cover any noise he made, and besides, he didn't know what to say. It would be enough merely to see her, as it had been in the fields, or when he'd hid behind the cedar log and watched her fold her family's laundry. He would follow along behind, listening to the rain pelt the trees, and watch her wind her way home. Where the trail hit the beach on Miller Bay, there was a wall of honeysuckle just past Blossom, salmon berries hanging in among it, and a few last wild roses blooming. Hatsue cut into the cedar woods. Ishmael followed her through a dell of ferns where white morning glory blossoms dotted the forest floor. A fallen cedar log hung with ivy bridged the dell. She slipped under it and turned up a side path that followed a shallow creek where 3 years before they'd sailed driftwood boats together. The path made three bends, and then Hatsue crossed the water on a log, hiked halfway up the cedar hillside, and ducked into the hollow tree they'd played in together when they were only 9 years old. Ishmael squatted beneath branches in the rain and watched the tree's entry for half a minute. His hair hung wet in his eyes. He tried to understand what had brought her here. He himself had forgotten about the place, which was a good half mile from his home. He remembered now how they'd packed moss underneath their legs and lolled in the tree looking up. It was possible to kneel, but not to stand, though on the other hand, the room inside the tree was wide enough to lie down in. They'd gone there with other kids and imagined they were hiding out, sharpening alder sticks with pocket knives to be used in their defense. The inside of the tree had been filled with a stock of arrows to be used in a fantasy battle at first, then in a battle fought amongst themselves. From twine and yew wood, they'd made miniature bows. They'd used the hollow cedar as a kind of fort and run up and down the hillside shooting at each other. Ishmael squatted there, remembering playing war on this hillside, and how that had ultimately driven the Syvertson girls away, and then the Imada sisters. And then he saw that Hatsue was looking at him from the entry of the hollow cedar tree. He looked back. There was no point in hiding. "You'd better come in," she said. "It's wet." "All right," he answered. Inside the tree, he knelt on the moss with water dripping beneath his shirt. Hatsue sat on the moss in her damp summer dress, her broad-rimmed picking hat beside her. "You followed me," she said. "Didn't you?" "I didn't mean to," Ishmael apologized. "It just happened, sort of. I was going home, you know what I mean? I saw you turn off, and it just happened, sort of. Sorry," he added. "I followed you." She smoothed her hair back behind her ears. "I'm all wet," she said. "I'm soaked." "So am I. It feels good, sort of. Anyway, it's dry in here. Remember this place? It seems smaller." "I've been coming here all along," said Hatsue. "I come here to think. Nobody else comes around. I haven't seen anybody here in years." "What do you think about?" Ishmael asked. "When you're here, I mean, what do you think about?" "I don't know. All sorts of things. You know, a place to think." Ishmael lay down with his hands propping up his chin and looked out at the rain. The inside of the tree felt private. He felt they would never be discovered here. The walls surrounding them were glossy and golden. It was surprising how much green-tinted light entered from the cedar forest. The rain echoed in the canopy of leaves above and beat against the sword ferns which twitched under each drop. The rain afforded an even greater privacy. No one in the world would come this way to find them inside this tree. "I'm sorry I kissed you on the beach," said Ishmael. "Let's just forget about it. Forget it happened." There was no answer at first. It was like Hatsue not to answer. He himself was always in need of words, even when he couldn't quite muster them. But she seemed capable of a brand of silence he couldn't feel inside. She picked up her straw hat and looked at it instead of him.
"Don't be sorry," she said with her eyes down. "I'm not sorry about it."
"Me neither," said Ishmael.
She lay down on her back beside him. The green-tinted light caught her face. He wanted to put his mouth against hers and leave it there forever. He knew now that he might do so without regretting it.
"Do you think this is wrong?" she asked.
"Other people do," said Ishmael. "Your friends would," he added, "and your parents."
"So would yours," said Hatsue. "So would your mother and father."
"Yours more than mine," said Ishmael. "If they knew we were out here in this tree together..." He shook his head and laughed softly. "Your father'd probably kill me with a machete. He'd slice me into little pieces."
"Probably not," said Hatsue. "But you're right, he would be angry. With both of us for doing this."
"But what are we doing? We're talking."
"Still," said Hatsue, "you're not Japanese, and I'm alone with you."
"It doesn't matter," answered Ishmael. They lay beside each other in the cedar tree, talking, until half an hour had gone by. Then, once again, they kissed. They felt comfortable kissing inside the tree. And they kissed for another half hour. With the rain falling outside and the moss softly under him, Ishmael shut his eyes and breathed the smell of her fully in through his nostrils. He told himself he had never felt so happy. And he felt a sort of ache that this was happening and would never again happen in just this way, no matter how long he lived.
Chapter 9. Ishmael found himself sitting in the courtroom, where Hatsue's husband was on trial for murder. He found he was watching her as she spoke to Kabuo, and he exerted himself to look away. The jurors returned, and then Judge Fielding, and Carl Heine's mother took the stand. Despite living in town a full 10 years, she retained the look of a farmer's wife, stout, faded, and wind-worn. Etta adjusted her girth in the witness chair so that the hitching and sliding of her undergarments was heard. Heavy nylons, a girdle purchased in Lotte Opsvig's shop, a back brace prescribed by a doctor in Bellingham for the sciatica she attributed to her farm days.